Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I am Kara Hetland, and Paula Poundstone has been doing stand-up comedy for about 40 years. She's been on several cable specials, and you can hear her frequently on the Saturday morning news quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She's bringing her comedy act to Sioux Falls next week at the Washington Pavilion, and we spoke earlier with Paula Poundstone. So thanks for taking time. I really appreciate you. And you're coming to South Dakota in a couple of weeks. Anything special you're doing to prepare to know what's going on in South Dakota?
No. Prepare is a word that doesn't often dawn on me. And perhaps I'd be better off if it did. I mostly sort of learn about the where I am from the audience. I really enjoy talking to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And in this way, little biographies of audience members emerge while I'm on stage, and I kind of use that from which to set my sails. People just tell you stuff. And oftentimes there's a local flavor to what they tell you, or to how the crowd reacts to what they told you. And so that's how I do it.
Everybody in the audience always totally honest with you?
I have no way of knowing. I don't have fact checkers. I suppose I interview people in a way, you know, I don't know. I think people often say things that they didn't know that they would say.
So they often surprise themselves.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And hopefully, by the way, there's just something so wonderful about a group of people who've come out to laugh for the night, you know. Obviously, you don't necessarily know all the other audience members as an audience member, but you know there's a world community feeling to being in a crowd of people out laughing for the night. But there's also a local community feeling to it that's nice. And I think with all the electronic options nowadays, people. You know, it's like it's emotional junk food. So much of it, you know, it's empty calories in an emotional sense. I don't think most of what we do on a computer. They use the word connectivity, and the way they co-opted the word friend. I don't think most of it's mentally healthy at all. Whereas, even if you don't know the people sitting on both sides of you, when you come out to hear a show, and by the way, it doesn't have to be me that you're going to see, but it has to be somebody, or go to dinner or go out with friends or whatever, that thing where you're with other people and you sort of share that emotional response is just so good for you. You can feel it from the minute you walk into the room.
Kind of a break from connectivity.
Honestly, and the more break we get from it, the better. I mean, what they're finding now, and it's not surprising, everybody knows it anecdotally. We all know it because we've seen it with our eyes and because we feel it in ourselves, which is that this stuff is diabolically bad for you. It stops the functioning of the frontal lobe. It stops the development of the frontal lobe in developing brains. It makes you feel less connected, not more connected. And because you always have that feeling, you know how you like hate to be away from your phone because it has your email on it, and you feel the need to constantly check. That puts everybody in this kind of fight or flight mode. You know, this feeling that it brings us back to our primal brain, our primitive brain, where we think some sort of carnivore may be coming around the corner any minute to eat us. So everybody's a little bit on edge. All that is generated by screens. So I'm pleased to be a night that doesn't necessarily involve screens.
So you don't incorporate technology into your shows?
I do not. In fact, I talk a lot on stage about the ill effects I talk about it comedically, but I am dead serious. It's you know, in China and South Korea, they consider this the number one threat to their public health is electronics addiction. And, you know, people try to tell me all the time, my manager is a terrible addict, and she says to me all the time, no, she enjoys it. That's it. She likes it. I said, let me tell you something. I love to play ping pong. I love to tap dance, and I love to practice the drums, and I have never once tried to do any of those things while driving in such a way as that the cops couldn't see, because I'm not compelled by those things. It's different. Loving something is very different than being compelled by it.
So do you ever call people out if you see them on their phone during your show? Do you call them out and bring them up?
I guess I have. I guess I have. I don't do it always. People are fairly surreptitious about it, I suppose. But remember, there was the guy at the New York Philharmonic, was it like a year or two ago, whose phone went off in the front row? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we haven't had that. Actually, come to think of it, I guess phones have gone off. I mean, you know, it's not like I want to come down on people for things. I do want them to pay attention to the fact that we're going down a bad path. And more importantly than them, whether they have their cell phone on during my show or not, more importantly is that, and this is going to be a, this will not be a well-received notion right out of the gate. But eventually, and I wish I could make a bet on it with everyone I talk to about it, eventually this big ship will turn, which is we have to get that stuff out of our schools. And I know most people are going to feel like this is a terrible idea and that we, you know, oh, it's so important for education. Apparently, there is no indication that it's better for education. And the possible downside is so enormous that why would we take that risk? Nobody thinks anymore. Nobody just allows themselves to go through their attic, so to speak, of their brain to come up with some. Everybody reaches for silly, stupid Google before they think of something on their own. I always say to people, if Robert Frost lived today, he would have written Whose Woods Are These? I think I'll Google it. It just doesn't seem right, mm-hmm, somehow.
Why do I have to know that when I can just look it up?
Yeah. And, you know, I'll tell you something. I was a believer in that philosophy at one point. It's just that what I've seen with my eyes and experienced tells me that, okay, it's like if you're in a corn maze, you know, and you think, well, no, you go left right here. And then you go left a little ways and you see the dead end. Well, guess what? You were wrong. So now you backtrack and you go another way. And that's where we're at with the computers in the schools right now. We made a mistake and we need to get them out. It's not helping education. It is, if you take the drop in SAT scores and you put it on a graph and you put it alongside what's happened with the proliferation of electronics, it's not, and I know it's not surprising to anybody to hear that as one rises, the other drops. Anybody with a kid knows this. Mm-hmm. But you know it just from looking around. Everywhere you go, people are staring at their flat things. And that's part of the reason why it's so great when they come out to see, again, a show doesn't have to be me, but it's, you know, you got to go out and have a sense of the energy of the people around you. Most places that you go now, either people are staring at their flat things or they have headphones in. So you couldn't even talk to them. You couldn't even say, hi, how are you? You know, hello. Now you have to say, hello. It's not nearly as much fun.
Sounds like you have some ideas for some great studies, but you're not always a fan of studies.
Well, okay, I am a fan of studies. Occasionally people have accused me of somehow being anti-science. Okay, when there's a study that indicates that cats are the only animal that forgives, that's not science. I don't know what it is, but that's not science. First of all, how the hell would you know if a hippo forgave you? And
he
what
didn't
on
eat
earth
you?
Did you... Yeah, I don't get... Right, exactly. They spare you. And I'm fairly certain that cats do forgive. I have 15 of them. Although, really, it would be in my cat's best interest if that science works the other way around, and the people forgave cats because, you know, I went to this PETA thing last night, and I it was an awards dinner and a show, and it was really great, and it was very instructive, very great. They are really one hell of an organization. They've brought a lot of attention to things that people didn't know about before, and I think would rather wasn't happening. You know, I think most people, when they find out how their food comes to their table, are not pleased when they find out about the cruelty to animals. I don't think most of us are inherently cruel, so it was a good it was a good thing. I was a good night, but I still came away when I came home to my 15 cats feeling that there really should be a cats for the ethical treatment of human group, because my gosh, they're a pain in the neck.
Who were your role models as a young comedian? Who did you look up to?
Let's see, Lily Tomlin. My parents had 11 Bill Cosby albums. I stole all 11 of them when I left home. Richard Pryor's stand-up movie, the first one, I saw a couple, but the first one was, and no one had ever done a movie of stand-up, like where, you know, there was in the movie theater that I know of. It is the most amazing work. Really, 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 I'm just genius every step of the way. It's, you know, it's because he does a thing where he tells a story about hunting with his dad, and he does a deer. You know, he imitates the deer, and you know, I think Richard Pryor might have been part deer. I mean, he had that face that he could make so sad and so vulnerable. Surely there had to be some deer in it. Let me think. I think my favorite comics are Bob and Ray, the old radio team. But probably the comic that I owe the most to, and I would say this is the case for pretty much all of my brethren of my sort of generation of stand-up comic, is Robin Williams, who not only was the most generous man I've ever known, but as a stand-up comic, he really changed. You know, stand-up comedy's been around since we came out of the caves. It's not like he invented it. But he changed a number of things about it. One thing is, for those of us who are not brilliant writers, he pretty much is the guy who did away with the segue. You know, Robin would skip around so. And so that became sort of okay to an audience. Whereas before that, if you sort of move from one subject to another too rapidly, it was kind of jarring for the listener. And they were always still puzzling over, you know, how come you left one topic for the other? What you know, while you're, you know, and missing punchlines as they were doing so. So he certainly did that. But the other thing is, because of that crazy sort of Tasmanian devil energy that he had, he just reinvigorated audiences' interest in the form of stand-up. He was a big star by the time I started, but he lived in the Bay Area. And he would come to the clubs. I started out in Boston, and then I took a Greyhound bus around the country to see what clubs were like in different cities, and I ended up in San Francisco. And, you know, this was especially the case in San Francisco, but this was all over the country, which was people came out to the clubs hoping that they would see Robin, and they often did. He was everywhere. And in the meantime, they saw us. And they found that there was a bunch of comics like myself that they did like. And so we got to have careers. But they came looking for Robin. And that was the case all over the country. There's not a, there's not a club or a theater in this country that does not have in the office of the manager somewhere a picture of Robin Williams on their stage. He would do a 3,000-seat amphitheater and then come over to Uncle Funny's Yuck House in the middle of the night. He was everywhere.
And you, the people that you admired, you got to know and work with.
I have, lots and lots. I've never met Carol Burnett. There were a lot of women that weren't stand-ups per se, but that were, you know, comic performers, comic actresses. I never met Lucille Ball, although I met her daughter. And I have not met Carol Burnett, although we've exchanged notes. When my show got canceled on ABC years ago, Carol Burnett sent me flowers, which I just thought was the sweetest thing. And at that point, we had just exchanged notes. I mean, that's sort of the big missing link, I think, really. But Lily is a close friend of both me and my children. And I remember years ago, this was probably about maybe 5 years ago or so, she was doing some sort of a fundraiser for an animal rights group. And she's done really great work, by the way, with elephants, trying to get elephants out of zoos and trying to get elephants out of circuses and at least get the way that they handle them changed. And they've made huge strides on that, and a lot of that is due to her. But anyway, so they were having this animal rights fundraisery thing somewhere. And so I took my kids, or my daughters anyways, my two daughters, and they were honoring Lily at this event. And she came out, and I don't know if she had planned to do this. I have no idea. It certainly looked spontaneous, which is George Slaughter, who was the producer, creator of Laugh-In, was there, and he was telling stories about Laugh-In and stuff. And he asked her to do the Rubber Freak. Do you remember that?
The Rubber Freak. I'm trying to remember.
It's she plays this character who is addicted to eating rubber.
Yes. Okay. Yep.
And I'm going to take a wild guess that her wife, Jane Wagner, wrote the piece. I'm not sure. I know Jane wrote a lot of Lily material over the years. But Lily, she transforms herself physically in the blink of an eye. She sort of, contorts her body a little bit, and she is this woman. She's sitting on a stool, and she said before she started it, she was like, "Well, I haven't done this in so long." And then, in just a heartbeat, she's into it, and she does this testimonial as this woman about how she began eating rubber, and how she can't, she can't stop. And I was so glad she did it while my girls were there, because it's just so brilliant and so funny. I felt like I had taken my kids to this, to like a rare natural resource. I felt like I'd taken them to Old Faithful, and you had to be there at a certain time of day, and we happened to catch it, She is a natural resource. She's a treasure.
Well, I appreciate your time and for letting us do this interview, and I look forward to seeing you when you're in South Dakota.
All right, please come up and say hi if you have the opportunity.
I will. Thank you so much.